We're holding Parshat Pinchas, and as usual, we'll try to run through the Parsha and then review it with more depth. Our Parsha is continuing the story we saw last week. The Jews had sinned at Arvos Moav by Shittim. Midianite women, Moabite women were standing right near Moab. It's called Arvos Moav, but somehow a Midianite princess lands on the scene, Cosby Vassur, and she goes and sins with Zimri ben Salu, the prince of Shimon, and up comes Pinchas. Pinchas was a student. He was a fine Talmud Chacham, but he wasn't held in such high esteem. He was the grandson of Jethro of Yisrael, and people looked down at him. They said, your grandfather used to be a chief idol worshiper. So Pinchas, he steps forward and he kills Zimri. And our parsha begins with that backdrop, with that history. We begin our parsha. And God says to Moshe, Pinchas really has great merits. He's the one that appeased my anger. And therefore give him my treaty of peace, my covenant of peace, and it will be eternal with him and his offsprings, for he avenged my anger. And God commands us to have an enmity towards the Midianites because of what they did to us. And God tells Moshe to count the Jewish people. So we have a count, and we'll have to discuss why count the Jewish people now. And then we're holding by Shlishi, and God tells him that these people that have been counted are the ones that are going to divide up the land and count the Levim, who don't get a portion in the land. And again, we have an enumeration of the Levim. And the daughters of Tzlafchat step forward, and the daughters come before Moshe and everyone, and they say, our father died without sons. You're dividing up the land. Our father doesn't have sons. Why should our father lack his inheritance in the land? We want our father's portion. And Moshe takes their case before God. And the question is, did Moshe not know the answer to their question? We'll have to discuss that. God tells Moshe, you know, they're right. Give them their father's portion, and their father was a firstborn, so give them their father's double portion. And then God tells Moshe, come up to this mountain of passing, Har Ha'avorim, and look at the land, and you're going to pass away too, just as your brother Aaron did. And Moshe sees that God is giving over inheritance of the land and inheritance to the daughters of Tzlafchat. Moshe tells God, let's appoint a leader. If I'm on my way out, who's going to lead them? And we need a leader that will lead them to war. Notice Jewish leaders are different than other leaders. They lead the way to war. They don't stay home in their castle and send their forces to the front. They're on the front lines. Moshe was on the front lines. Yeshua was on the front lines. David was on the front lines. And God tells Moshe, take Yeshua Binun. He is exceptional. He has God's spirit within him. In counter distinction with Zakenim that had God's spirit upon them, he has God's spirit within him. And place your hand on him, and he'll stand as the leader before Elazar the Kohen, and you'll appoint him before everyone else, and you'll give him honor, and you'll let him give the speech. He'll be the one running the show. And everyone will see that you're appointing him as the leader to take your place. And he'll ask a question before God through the Kohen Gadol, an act that only the leader can do. And the Jews will see that I answer him through the Kohen Gadol, that he's their new leader. And Moshe does as God told him, and Moshe places his two hands on Yehoshua. Notice the beginning of creation began with the sin of being niggardly, miserly. The beginning of creation began with the land being told to produce fruit and tree that has the taste of the fruit. And what did the land do? It said, okay, we'll produce one tree that has the taste of the fruit, the esrog, and all the other trees. The trees, the bark doesn't have good flavor, right? Only the fruit has flavor. And here we see Moshe Rabbeinu reverting that sin. God told him to place one hand on Yehoshua, and Moshe puts both hands on Yehoshua. He gives him above and beyond. He tries to give as much as he can, as opposed to the sin of the earth that tried to give the minimum. We always have that choice in life. Do we do the minimum? If you're a worker, so you always feel like, I put in my hours, I've done my job. And a person can always say, no, I want the company to succeed. I'm going to do my best. So Moshe Rabbeinu does, he puts both hands on Yehoshua. And he blesses Yehoshua and he gives him smicha. Yehoshua is the first one that got smicha, and we'll discuss that concept later. And then we have an enumeration of the sacrifices of each day. We've had some of these sacrifices discussed before. We have the sacrifice of Rosh Chodesh. We have the sacrifices of Pesach, the sacrifice of Shavuos, the sacrifice of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Kippur. All the different holidays, their sacrifices are enumerated in our parsha. And that takes us through the end of the parsha. So now let's review the parsha with more depth. We have mitzvos in the Torah. And the mitzvos are divided into chova, mitzvah, reshut. Obligatory, commandment, and permissive. Torah says, if a person murdered someone by mistake, he was driving recklessly and he killed someone. So he was reckless, but he didn't mean to kill someone. So then the relatives have a right to take his blood. The relatives have a right to avenge their relative's death. He has a right to flee to the cities of refuge. Part of his punishment is that he should be on the run. He should be in a city of refuge. That's part of the tshuva that he has to do. He has to run. He did something reckless. The Torah wants him to run. If one of those relatives walks before a court and says, "Rabbis, I see the guy who killed my brother. Can I shoot him?" Yeah. Should I shoot him? Good question. That's discussed. There are different opinions. So although the Torah permits him to do something, does the Torah obligate him to do it? There are certain things which the Torah tells us we may do. Does that mean we must do? The Torah says that if a person's brother passed away without children, so then he can marry his sister-in-law so that there will be children in his brother's name. Or else he can do chalitza, a procedure of freeing her to the market. Which one is preferable? Are they both called mitzvos? So that's a discussion. Again, it's a discussion in the Tanoim, Amoraim, which is preferable. The Torah says one can take a vow. He takes a vow that he's going to learn 10 daf a day. Is that permissible? Is that preferable? So we rule halachically that if anyone takes a vow, it's as though he established an improper altar to bring a sacrifice. We know today you're not allowed to bring sacrifices. We don't have a temple. If one builds an altar and brings a sacrifice, he's doing biblical obligations. Our sages said, if one makes a vow, it's as though he built an improper altar. If he fulfills it, so then it's as though he brought a sacrifice upon it. That's how we rule halachically. You're not supposed to take nedarim. There's a question whether this applies to shavuos, but nedarim, no one's supposed to make nedarim. Neder is a form of a vow. You're not supposed to take a vow. And if you take a vow, you're supposed to go to a rabbi and find out a way to get it annulled. So not everything that it says in the Torah is obligatory. We know that there's milchemet chova, milchemet mitzvah, milchemet reshut. If the Jews are under attack, then every Jew has to join and help in protecting the Jewish people. Sometimes we have a mitzvah to conquer the land of Israel. And sometimes you have a situation where the forces just want to expand the land, which today we don't have the power to do that, but in King David's time, we could take a war just to expand our territory. So there are different types of wars. There's a war that's obligatory, there's a war that's a mitzvah, and then there's a war that's a reshut. So when we read about mitzvos in the Torah, we have to know which mitzvos are obligatory, and which mitzvos are good things to do, which mitzvos are reshut. Moshe Rabbeinu had taught the Jewish people that if a person goes with a non-Jewish woman, so if he marries her, that's biblically prohibited. It is biblically prohibited for a Jewish man to marry a non-Jewish woman. Now what about if he goes on a one-time basis? One time, like Zimri did with Cosby. That's also prohibited. But for that we don't have the same punishment. For that, we have a special tradition that a person who's been board certified, the rabbi certified him as a kanoi, a person who the rabbi said he's attained the level that he is a zealot, a righteous zealot, meaning many people feel like they're zealots, but they're not righteous zealots. If he's reached the level that he's righteous enough that the rabbis certify him that he's zealous for the sake of God's name, he may go up and kill the person, assuming he could catch the person in the act. A second later, he may not. A second earlier, he may not. During the time of the act of the sin, he may kill the person and the woman. He may kill the person, not necessarily the woman, because who said non-Jews are prohibited to be with Jews? Jews are prohibited to go with non-Jews, with non-Jewish women. That doesn't mean there's a prohibition on the non-Jewish woman. So we discussed last week why Cosby was put to death, because she caused the Jews to sin with idol worship. That, even non-Jews are prohibited. But Pinchas stepped up and killed Zimri and Cosby. So the Jews were talking. They said, okay, God permitted him to do it. It was within the letter of the law. But who said God wanted him to do it? Who said that this is one of those mitzvahs that you're supposed to do? And so the tribe started talking and they're saying, who is this Pinchas? His grandfather served idols. Who's he to stand up to the Nasi, the head of the tribes of Israel, one of the chief of the tribes? And the Pasuk comes here and does a comparison. And the Pasuk is trying to allude to us. The Pasuk is reminding us of the history of the Jewish people. Let's go back a few hundred years. Yaakov ran from his brother Esav, you remember, he ran to Lavan. He had 11 children. He came back to the land of Israel. And he bought a piece of land outside Shechem. And his daughter Dinah walked out. And Hamor wanted to capture her. He heard there's a good-looking girl around. He brought the girls of the land to play games out there, to play music, to dance. She looks out her window. She sees a Tzanua festival, only girls dancing. So she joins. She goes outside. She wants to see what's going on. Hamor kidnaps her, takes her into his palace. And her brothers are upset. Two brothers stand up and decide we're going to wipe out the town. Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi say, what? To kidnap a girl, to take her forcibly, this is terrible. We're going to destroy this town. And the whole town doesn't say a word. A few hundred years have passed. Shimon and Levi have become tribes. When it comes to the sin of the Egel, the tribe of Levi shows that they've taken that trait of zealousness and they've used it for good. At Yaakov's death, he chastised Shimon and Levi's anger. He said, with your anger, you tried to murder your brother. That anger allowed you to go against Yosef. You're the two that conspired to really uve'apamiku sho. With your anger, you wanted to uproot the ox. Your brother was compared to an ox. That's Yosef. But now a few generations have passed. And Shimon and Levi have evolved into tribes. And now we have a face-off again between these two tribes. The tribe of Shimon failed miserably at the beginning of our journey through the desert. They served the Egel. The tribe of Levi did not. The tribe of Shimon sinned when it came time for sending the spies to the land of Israel. The tribe of Levi did not. And now, The tribe of Levi didn't have a spy, but I don't know if they sinned with regard to what was said. But now, when we're standing at the threshold, we're about to enter the land of Israel, we have a face-off. Pinchas, from the tribe of Levi, is the one that stands up for God's name against Shimon, Zimri, who's the head of the tribe of Shimon, who went with this Midianite woman in front of everyone. And so the Pasuk compares. The Pasuk says, Pinchas, who's the son of Elazar, who's the son of Aaron, the Kohen, he's a Levite. He was a Kanoi. And can you believe it? The Pasuk is saying that the one who sinned, he's Zimri ben Salu, the head of the tribe of Shimon. This is the tribe of Shimon? They were so zealous for improper relationships with women and then their own Nasi does it. So the people of Israel were talking badly about Pinchas. They were saying, this is like the din of Eshes Yefas Tor. Like that, yeah? They were saying, it's true that what Zimri did was wrong, but he wasn't marrying her. So what he did constituted something where, just like the Torah says, when you go to war and you see a beautiful non-Jewish woman, you may take her, but the Torah doesn't recommend you take her. By the same token, when Zimri did what was wrong, you may kill Zimri, but who says the Torah recommends it? And so the tribes were speaking badly about him, and God says, wait a second. If not for him, there was a plague going on. People were dropping dead. Thanks to him, the plague stopped. And that's what God said. No, Pinchas did good.
But I don't understand. What's his name? What's the leader of Shimon?
Zimri.
The leader of Shimon. What he does is much more severe than what Pinchas is doing.
Okay, God agreed with you. God said like you. So Pinchas, initially when the Kohanim were anointed, so God told Aaron, you're a Kohen, and your sons are Kohanim, and the children they will have from now on will be Kohanim. What about the children that they had prior to that time? Those children are not Kohanim. Pinchas was born prior to Aaron and his children becoming Kohanim. So even though Aaron was made Kohen and his children were made Kohanim, Pinchas was not a Kohen until this day. And now God gave him the gift not only of being Kohen, but Kohanim Gedolim throughout the temple were from Pinchas' offspring. The Kohanim Gedolim came from Pinchas. And God says, I will therefore give him my treaty of peace. The Torah promises us that when we go to war, God will give us a special gift. Ordinarily, when people go to war, they become cruel. If a person spends his time killing people, if a person spends his time looking through the enit, looking through the eye hole of a shotgun, well, it does something to a person. You're constantly thinking about where to shoot, how to shoot, who to shoot. The Torah gives a special promise that the Jewish people, even when they go to war, when they come home, they'll be normal. We know that after Vietnam, a lot of the veterans came home and they were vicious and cruel and they had serious problems getting back into society. Well, we don't find that here. We find that the promise the Torah gave us that the Jewish people will remain compassionate and good people, that promise held not only in the times of the temple, we see it today too. Our soldiers come back home, you don't see them getting into brawls in the bars. You don't see that. You see every citizen in the country, many citizens in the country, are serving in the army and they come back and they're peaceful citizens. That's a blessing. Pinchas gets up and he takes a spear and he just killed two people. And what does God give him? God gives him a covenant of peace. Yeah?
Where do you see that promises in?
I have to remember. It's either in Shoftim or Kitetze. To look it up. It's in the book of Dvar. So God gives him the treaty, the covenant of peace. When you're in shul this Shabbos, take a look at the Sifrei Torah. Especially if you're in a Sfardi shul, so they do Hagbah in the beginning. So in the beginning of the Parsha, we have this verse. It's the third verse in the Parsha. We have on tradition that the Vav is cut. It's called the Vav Ketua. It's a smaller Vav. Et Briti Shalom. And that's an allusion to the fact that the word should be read also as Shalem, whole. God says, I will make Pinchas whole because of this story. And the Medrash expands on the importance of peace, that we know we end prayer with peace, we end Kaddish with peace. The Jewish people have always strived for peace, true peace, but peace nonetheless. The treaty, the covenant that God makes with Pinchas is that he'll be whole. Pinchas never passed away. Pinchas became Elio, and Pinchas remained alive and is with us to this day. And that's what God says. I will give him a covenant of a wholeness. He will be whole.
He became Elio?
Pinchas who Elio, yeah. Pinchas is Elio. That doesn't work. And there are many questions on that. And there are many midrashim that don't go that route. And the Gemara says that one Amora met Elio in a graveyard. And he said, wait a second, if you're Pinchas, you're a Kohen, you're not allowed to be in a graveyard. So the Gemara discusses it, and the Midrashim discuss it, and not every Midrash agrees with this, not every Rishon agrees with this, but we do have such a tradition, that Pinchas hu Elio.
I thought Rosh said that he was talking about his Gilgul or something.
Some Rishonim say it was his Gilgul, you could understand that way, yeah. And Ibn Ezra, I think, here has a very interesting point. He says, God says this will be a treaty for him and his offsprings after him. Well, if he's always alive, there's no such concept as after him. So that's why I think it's Ibn Ezra, the Chizkuni, one of them, Farshim say, from here we see that it's clearly a Medrash. It doesn't mean literally that he remained alive. The Pasuk stresses that who did he kill? He killed Zimri. He killed a leader among the Jewish people, and that takes guts. Is there any way we could get Ari Weber in here? Or is he learning now? Okay. Huh? No, no. If it'll take more than a minute, then don't bother. Yeah?
Are you coming also to Yitro? Is it because about Yitro in this question?
No. I don't think so.
When we had the Pasha from Yitro, then there was a discussion if we came back to Israel or not.
Right.
Now, is this not the fulfillment? What's going on here now?
That one.
It just ends that he went back to where Midian or where, but there was no point in saying that he really came, he joined really. Is this the fulfillment for me?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. So who is this Zimri? We don't encounter the name Zimri earlier in the Torah. So we have on tradition that Zimri had three names. His real name was Shlumiel ben Tzuri Shaddai. And that's the name we encounter throughout the Torah. That was the Nasi of Shimon. He was also known as Shaul ben Haknanis, and he was also known as Zimri ben Salu. Zimri, because we have in Hebrew very often that words are interchangeable, like keves, kesev. So Zimri comes from the word muzar. Beitzam muzara is a scrambled egg. So Zimri was called Zimri because it became like a scrambled egg. Ben Salu, because he, to be masli is like to filth. He caused his family name to be filthy. He's called Shaul because he lent himself to sin. Ben Aknan is because he behaved like Canaan. He behaved improperly. So the Pasuk tells us who Pinchas's father and grandfather and his lineage was, and it tells us who Zimri's lineage was. And this is important because we have to know that when we're behaving, we're reflecting not only on ourselves, but we're reflecting on our forefathers and our family as well. A person doesn't live in a vacuum, and a person doesn't behave in a vacuum. When people will think about who our family is, that we're reflective of that. And that's a message to you guys going out to the army. We're going to focus on you today. That when you're going, you're representing all of us. The Gemara says if one from the Chabua, if one from the group, we're going to focus on you today. Hope you don't mind. If one from the group, God forbid, passes away, so the whole group has to be fearful, because in heavens we're judged together. So it's not only in heavens, in earth also. When one from the group goes out, he's representing the group. So you're representing all of us. God tells Moshe, maintain enmity for the Midianites. And now the question is, how do we work out this parsha? We were situated at Arvos Moav, and the Jews started sinning with the Moabite women. And then in the middle of it all, we identify one woman who's the daughter of the king Tzur, the chief king of Midian. What was she doing there? How'd she get there? So our sages tell us that Cozbi was a very, very, very good-looking girl. And you guys familiar with the book Ben Sira? That's a book written, unclear who it's written by, possibly Jeremiah's son. From the Apophakra, however you pronounce it. Okay, he said it. So the Gemara quotes a verse over there. It's not biblical, but the verse says, "B'toar isha yafa rabim ushchatu." With the beauty of a good-looking woman, many have been destroyed. So using this thought, the Midianites went to their king and said, you have a really, really good-looking daughter. If we want the Jews to sin, we got to send her out there. She's going to make them sin like crazy. So Tzur agreed. And here we see that the Midianites were the source of this plot. We have a tradition that the source of this plot was Bilam and the Midianites. The Midianites told the Moabites, you want the Jews to fall, you have to send your girls out there and cause them to sin and cause them to serve the idol of Baal Peor. And from Bilam. But Bilam, where was Bilam's source? So Bilam's source, according to some, was also Midian. At any rate, they sent the daughter of their king out there. That shows a special hatred for the Jewish people to cause us to sin. And now God says, I want you to hold it in, hold it against the Midianites. And this this came to play in three different fashions. Firstly, ordinarily when we go to war, we offer the nation peace. We don't go to war without offering them peace on our terms. We say, if you agree to our terms, then we could remain in peace. If not, we're going to have a war. Not so with the Midianites. Secondly, when we go to war against Midian, we destroy their trees. Ordinarily, we have a mitzvah Baal Tashvis. We're not allowed to be destructive. Where even when we go to war, we're not supposed to destroy unnecessarily. When it comes to the Midianites, God says, hold your enmity against them, destroy their trees as well.
Only fruit trees,
all right? Fruit trees, yeah. Well, fruit trees also. If you need the space, you need to build a house, you could destroy it. But unnecessarily, we're not supposed to destroy them.
So they're supposed to wipe out their trees also?
That's what we find in Malachim, yeah. When they came to Elisha, and they asked him, and they were going to war, Yehoshaphat, and I don't remember who the king of Israel was. They went to war, and Elisha told them, destroy everything, even their trees, and fill up stuff up even their wells. So they asked him, but Thor says you're not allowed to. So Elisha said, no, Midian you are, because we're supposed to hold a special enmity for them. And this brings us to the third point. We have a rule, habalo gecha shkem v'ogo. If they tell you someone's out to kill you, kill him first. We had Gedalia ben Achikam. After the temple was destroyed, the Babylonian Empire established a governor named Gedalia, and he was responsible for the Jews that remained. Gedalia was told that Yishmael ben Netanya was coming to kill him. So Gedalia said, I don't believe it. He wouldn't kill me. Shmuel ben Netanya killed him and caused the total destruction of the remaining Jewry in the land of Israel. Yeah?
A couple things. One, aren't you supposed to not kill them if you can help it?
Oh, so we say Gedalia should have at least suspected that Yishmael might kill.
But isn't that Lashon Hara? Like, they say that you're going to kill him. And like, we've had plenty of examples like that.
So we say that he didn't have to believe him. It was Lashon Hara. So Gedalia said, it's Lashon Hara, I don't believe it. And Chazal say, he shouldn't have said, I don't believe it. He should have said, I can't believe that he definitely wants to kill me, but I have to suspect that maybe he does want to kill me and protect myself. And Gedalia said, no, I don't believe it at all. But let's say a person's at home and he sees a robber walking in with his shotgun out. So we say, if the guy's coming with a gun into your house, you shoot him before he shoots you. Habalo gecha, if someone's coming to kill you, you kill him first. And the Torah is telling us that God told the Jewish people, you should know that the Midianites have revealed that they're going to be a constant threat to you. And therefore you have to maintain constant enmity towards them. And we have a discussion, which is greater? The miracle of Hanukkah or the miracle of Purim? So people would think, look, in Hanukkah they didn't try to kill us. In Purim we're almost killed. But in Hanukkah they said, we don't need to kill you. But you have to all become, adopt the Greek philosophies and leave Judaism. Stop circumcising, stop keeping Shabbos. So we say, right, we say that if someone tries to make someone else sin, he is worse than someone who tries to kill him. Because if you kill someone, you've only killed them in this world. Whereas if you've caused them to sin, you've hurt them in this world and in the world to come. And that's why when it comes to the Egyptians, when it comes to the Edomites, they both fought us. But it was a war, who's going to kill whom? They didn't try to make a sin. So therefore, a third generation may enter the Jewish people. Ammon, Moab, they caused us to try and sin. So there God says, no generation, we don't accept them into the people of Israel. To do good in the future. But you haven't brought him down as far as causing him to sin in the present. That's true. That's true, right? We're not saying it's good to kill. That's true.
I was in this conversation.
I hear. I would also think so. There.
I mean, if you're going to make them sin for the rest of their life, then yeah, just kill them. But it's just one sin. I don't see not killing is better. I mean, it's just.
There was once a guy who came to a rabbi, and he said, I don't believe in God. So the rabbi told him, I agree with you. I don't either. So the guy said, but you're a rabbi, how could you say that? So he said, well, you'll describe to me the God you don't believe in, and I'm willing to guarantee I don't believe in him either. The type of God you're talking about, I don't believe in. I think that in order to understand this concept, we would have to take the remainder of this class to discuss what it means to cause someone to sin, what it means to kill someone, and why we view sin that way. And from the amount of explanation we've evolved this far, I agree with you. I think that it does. We should take time on a different occasion to discuss it as part of a larger discussion, a discussion of mitzvot and avirot, which will lead us also to a discussion of gender, also male versus female. How can we say shalos an ish every morning? Meaning that also is part of this larger discussion of how we view mitzvot and the fact that we merit to be able to perform mitzvot, which will also lead us to a discussion about the value of a Jew and the relationship when we view Jew and non-Jew. And this is a much larger discussion, which we should have, but we don't have the time for today. But at this point, I hear your point 100%. We have to have that discussion, just not now.
Maybe possible that the AC could be a bit lower, because I have the feeling I followed this.
I have a recording that says you need one of the air conditioning on.
So we have mitzvah to count the Jewish people again in our parasha, and there are a few understandings. Firstly, a lot of Jews died, and God says, "I love them." When you love someone, so you check, how are they doing? So a lot of Jews died. God said, I want you to show them I love them again, that I want a count of how many are left. Secondly, Moshe is finishing his career now. And God says, I gave him to you a certain number. Now I want you to count them before I give them back. And thirdly, we're going to divide up the land. So God says, we need a count before we divide up the land. Yeah?
It doesn't make so much sense for me that he needs to count because of that, because these people anyway have to die, that there are the rest of generations.
No. Whoever had to die finished dying. We're at the end of the 40 years, yeah. We got there last week. By Bokul Haida Kadesh. These are the people that are entering Israel, correct. So we have the count, and in the count we have a lot of interesting things. Firstly, every family is recorded with a Hanemu Eli. With the hay in the beginning and the yud at the end. And our sages tell us that Edut, God says, I'm giving testimony. The nations used to say, what are you saying? You're a nation. You're not a nation. You're half Egyptians, all of you. If the Egyptians had control of your bodies, certainly they had control of your wives. So half of your kids are Egyptians. They're not your own kids. And God said, I'll testify that all of them did somehow maintain faithfulness to one another. And that's why God put his name, a yud and a hey, around each name. Ha yachini, ha zarchi. Hey in the beginning, yud in the end. To testify that these are the Jewish people. And genetically, they are all from one family. And they're the holy Jewish people. When the psukim list the Jewish people, so the psukim list Dasan and Aviram and those that died. And the psukim tell us that all of the family of Palu, everyone passed away with Korach, Dasan and Aviram, except for Nemuel. And it's also telling us that they lost their portion in the land of Israel. Yeah?
What about the Arab tribes that came out of Egypt with Israel? Did they start marrying into the tribes?
There's a discussion about that. I don't remember. There's a discussion about that in last week's parsha. I don't remember. I have to look it up. I just saw something about that. That the Erev Rav, basically there was one tribe that married into the Erev Rav. Shimon married into the Erev Rav. And Shimon, those that married into the Erev Rav, are those that passed away in last week's parsha. That's what I think it says in the Midrash. That all the other tribes did not, and Shimon did. And that's why Shimon fell in this plague. That's if I'm not mistaken, that's what the Midrash says. We have something interesting that initially in Bereishis or Shmos, the Pasuk tells us that Binyamin had children named Ard and Naaman. Bela, Ard, and Naaman. And in our parsha it says that Bela had children named Ard and Naaman. Now the question is, they were supposed to be his brothers. How did they become his children? So the simple understanding is that the Pasuk sometimes calls grandchildren children. And another understanding is that Bela had siblings named Ard and Naaman, and they passed away without children. And then Bela had children, which he named Ard and Naaman. Now, if that's so, then I speculated something, which I don't know if it's correct. This was my speculation. Bela was the eldest brother. He had two younger siblings, Ard and Naaman. Now, we could say that Ard and Naaman both lived fruitful lives till the age of 50, 60, and they died. And then Bela had two more children, even though he was older than them, and named them Ard and Naaman. But that doesn't seem so likely, right? If he's older than them, he would have kids. So what do we have to say? That they died relatively young. Today we have a custom that we don't name kids after someone that passed away young. And this is a serious custom. I mean, I know someone who did, and that child died young. And it seems to be a custom that people take seriously. But if my speculation is right, then we have a source here in Tanakh that Bela named his children after his siblings that died young, Ard and Naaman. But that's all speculation.
How young?
It doesn't say.
Now, how young is the custom?
I don't know.
Does young mean less than 70?
I don't know. What?
Does young mean under 70?
I don't think so. I don't think it means under 70. No. The Pasuk, when it tells us the children of Dan and Ephraim, it specifies Eile. These are the children of Dan and Ephraim. Who remembers where we have the term Eile in Tanakh? Famous Eile. Okay. When it comes to a certain famous sin of the Jewish people. By a sin of the Jewish people. What does it say? Eile Elokecha Yisrael. When the Jews were dancing around the eagle, they said, "These are your gods, Israel, that took you out of Israel, so out of Egypt." So we have two tribes that brought idol worship into the Jewish people. Yerovam ben Nevat from the tribe of Ephraim established an idol in the tribe of Dan. And by these two tribes, Ephraim and Dan, it says the word Eile. These are the children of Dan, these are the children of Ephraim. It's a remez to the idol worship that they instituted in the land of Israel. But when we finish the enumeration of the offsprings of the Jewish people, we also end with Eile. La Eile Techalei Karetz. To teach us that all of them, their sins were forgiven, and they all became like the tribe of Levi, which are also called Eile, Eile Pekudei Levi. God did forgive the Jewish people. We have, you guys have special merits in heaven. God loves you. And I'll tell you why. Because you asked me a far out question on Sunday. And I asked myself, where am I going to find the answer? And I basically gave up when I walked out of class. And then today, God sent me the answer. I was preparing class today. And the question was, you guys asked, if someone, we discussed on Sunday in our Tanakh class, what happens if you adopt a child? So he said, it's as though you bore that child. And then guys asked, what about when you get an aliyah to the Torah? Does the child get named after the person who adopted him? And what about all other things? So I didn't know where to look. And then we have in our parsha, V'shem bat Asher Sarach. The name of the daughter of Asher is Sarach. Now, there are all kinds of midrashim that say that Sarach bas Asher, Sarach, the daughter of Asher, never passed away. And we discussed this last week, that when Yoav was coming to destroy the city, what city was it? Avel Beis Macha, where Sheva ben Bichri was hiding. So there was a wise woman who came out of the city and said, "Are you Yoav? You call yourself Av, father to the Jewish people? You're not a father to the Jewish people. You want to wipe out a city." So Yoav said, "And who are you?" And she said, "I'm an old mother of the Jewish people." She was Sarach bas Asher. She was the wise woman who came out of the city. So I was researching. I was looking for the Medrash. There's a Medrash that says she didn't pass away. And through this research, I came to the answer to the question you guys posed in the beginning of the week. The Ramban quotes the Targum on this pasuk. The Targum says, the name of the daughter of the wife of Asher was Sarach, meaning she wasn't Asher's daughter. Asher married a woman who had a daughter from a previous marriage named Sarach, and Asher brought her up. And when the pasuk says that Sarach was the daughter of Asher, the pasuk is saying Asher brought her up, he adopted her, and that's why she's called the daughter of Asher. That's the Ramban from the Targum in this week's parsha. Now, a question was sent to the Chasam Sofer. A man married a woman and had children, and then one of his children married the man's sister, married the aunt. So people came to the rabbi and said, "How'd you allow this wedding to happen? It's Gilui Arayis, it's prohibited." So the rabbi took the question to the guy. He said, "How'd you let your son marry your sister?" So the guy said, "Well, he's not really my son. When I married this girl, she had an illicit relationship beforehand. She used to work as a maid in Rav Moshe Sofer's house. And she had a child out of wedlock. And the child was 4 years old. And when I married her, so she already had this child 4 years old. He isn't my son. And so therefore, he can marry my sister because he's not really my son. So the question was, but when he gets called up to the Torah, he's called the son of Eliyahu, the new husband. When he wrote the Ksuba, he signed the Ksuba, I am Avram, the son of Eliyahu. So the rabbi said, how are you telling me I'm supposed to believe you? He's not your son. If everywhere he calls himself the son of Eliyahu. So the first thing the Chasam Sofer says, based upon our parsha, is that the fact that he calls himself the son of Eliyahu, even when he gets called up to the Torah, you'd say, from our parsha we see, a person might claim that out of fondness, you could call an adopted son my son. And the son could call his father my father. But the Torah shows us not that way. The Torah shows us that when the Torah is recording who is Asher's daughter, it calls Sarah his daughter, and there it has no relevance to fondness. So from here we see that a person who's adopted, says the Chasam Sofer, and this isn't his own concept, this is Agos Maimoni, he quotes a Chuvus Agos Maimoni, that an adopted child may call the adopted father his father when he goes up to the Torah, and when he writes legal documents, and the Ksuba, and that doesn't mean he's his father. In the end, he says that they have to divorce. That's his final ruling. He says it's ridiculous. So who says? We don't know who the real father was. There's a good chance that this guy was the real father, and the guy was just playing a trick. And he goes on to prove that there were contradictions in testimony as to what really happened. And he ends up proving that the kid has to divorce from his aunt. And we suspect, we have good reason to suspect, that he really is the son of this father. But in doing so, in passing, he answers all the question you guys posed on Sunday, that a kid can go up to the Torah and call his stepfather his father, using his stepfather's name. Yeah.
Can.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't know.
Is there a deeper reason beyond?
1 second, Mayor's waiting. Sorry.
Which means that he also is adopting the name, the title Kohen.
No. He's not a Kohen. That doesn't make him a Kohen. He can just say, he could call himself the son of, because that person brought him up, and therefore he can talk to him and about him like he's his father. And the Derech Eretz is, he should call him father.
There must be a deeper side to this than the technicality.
That we discussed Sunday. We discussed the deeper side. Now, this gives us, sorry, in a nutshell, what we said is that the concept of Pru-Rvu has two aspects. The aspect of bringing a child to the world and educating him. And this person educated him, so there is an aspect where he really fathered him. That's in a nutshell what we said. Now, from here we see that Moshe Rabbeinu, even before the daughters of Tzlafchat came before him, Moshe Rabbeinu already knew that a daughter inherits her father. Why? Because this girl, who was the daughter of Asher, came with the wealth from her father's house. She was an only daughter, there was no one left. She took the wealth. She came and she was brought up by Asher, but she already had her father's wealth, whoever her original father was. And that's why when the daughters of Tzlafchat come, Moshe knows that a daughter can inherit her father. Moshe's doubt is, does she also inherit the double portion? Yeah.
Just because she had the portion doesn't mean that that's necessarily the correct thing, though.
So, okay. I don't know. So what they want to say is that she didn't get that portion without Moshe's ruling on it. Meaning she got her father's portion because Moshe ruled on it. Okay, so how were the portions divided? Eliezer, who was the Kohen Gadol, now that Aaron passed away, he wore the special clothing of the Kohen Gadol. All the Jewish people stood in front. Hey, this is where it's being decided. You know, it's like a Yerusha. You know, when there's a will, there's a way. When there's a will, there are many, many anxious inheritors. So here we're dividing up the land of Israel. So this is going to be their plot for eternity. So everyone was there. No one slept late that day. Everyone shows up. All the Jews are standing there. And Eliezer wears his clothing of Kohen Gadol. And they're going to draw lots. So they have a box. And inside is a lot that says the name of the tribe. They have another box that says the different portions in the land of Israel. And this shows us that they knew the geography of the land. And Eliezer would say, with Ruach HaKodesh, he'd say, if I'm going to pick up Zvulun, so then Akko is going to come out with him. And then he'd quickly stick his hand in and pull his hand out of the box, and they'd look at it, and it would say Zvulun. Okay. And if and then he'd stick his hand in and quickly pull out Akko, a land, and it would be Akko. And the same thing went with each tribe. Right. He'd prophesize beforehand what he would say, and there's a medrash that says that the lots would talk, and they'd say, I am the lot of this and this tribe, and that's why lots really caused that there wouldn't be fights, because otherwise there would be big fights. Very good. So the Torah tells us there were no men left over in this count and in the division of the land from those that had sinned in the Meraglim, but women did remain because the women didn't sin in the desert. The daughters of Tzlafchad come forward, and the Torah again tells us that the daughters of Tzlafchad tells us their lineage, they go back to Yosef. Yosef was the first Jew in Chutz Laaretz that showed an affinity for the land of Israel. When Yosef was about to pass away, he told the Jewish people, remember, take me up to the land of Israel, take my casket up. So he loved the land of Israel, and the Torah shows us that his daughters went in his footsteps. Oh, wait, I had something for you. Sorry. Let's go back a little bit. The name of the daughter of Asher was Serach. Now, for those of you, people asked for a little bit of Kabbalah and a little bit of Hasidut, so now this is our section, our few minutes in the class of this. What does it mean, the name of the daughter of Asher is Serach? So this is a question that was asked to the Torah Lishma, Shalos and Tshuva Sefer, and he first quotes from the Rishonim that he says that, first of all, everyone knew her, she had a reputation. So they knew her, she's the good doer, she's the do-gooder. So the Pasuk says, yeah, she has a name. Her name is Serach. That's the first pshat. We know Serach never died. She's one of those that enter Gan Eden alive. And beyond that, he says, could be that everyone used to call her Serach with a samach, which is like a leftover, and the Torah says, no, her name is Serach with a sin. Or they always used to call her the daughter of Asher. So the Torah is reminding us she has a name. She's called Serach. You know, in some crowds, you call a guy by his last name, right? So the Torah is like telling us she has a name. But then he quotes from, there's also one of God's hidden names is Vav Beis Aleph Shin, which is Rosh Tevos V'Shem Bas Asher Sarach. I don't know whatever that means. And then he quotes from the Arizal, that when a person is born, so his parents get Ruach HaKodesh, and they give him a name. They say in the name of Tzvi Yehuda, that he said, people come to me and ask me what to name their kids, and I don't understand it. God finally gives them a little bit of Ruach HaKodesh, and they're coming to ask me. God's giving parents Ruach HaKodesh when they name their kids. So the source of that is this Arizal. The Arizal says that when parents name their children, God makes it that they have Ruach HaKodesh, and there are two names that every person gets. There's the name of the Neshama, and that's what the parents give him. And that's how, and that name really is the source of that person up in the Kisei HaKavod. And that's how Rabbi Yehoshua ben Kocha and Rabbi Meir used to notice a person's name, and from that they could derive his traits. And just like there's a name for the neshama, every person that's down here has neshama and klipot. He has the externals that try to pull him down. We know we're composed of physical and spiritual. And by the same token that one has a name that's revealed that represents his neshama, there's the name that represents the klipa. And so long as a person is living here, if he would know the name of his klipa, so then he'd know what his challenges were. Meaning every person has specific challenges to overcome, and that's called the klipa, and that has a representation of a name. And if we would only know what that were, then we'd easily be able to overcome it. So God made it that name is hidden. But when a person becomes a tzaddik, so then when a person is a rasha, so then there's great connection to the klipa, and then when he passes away, he has to undergo, it's called chivut hakever, the pangs of passing away and then decomposing. Well, whatever it is, I don't know. After experiencing it, someone will tell us. But
heard it was his person was shaken.
And part of what happens when a person passes away is they ask him, what's your name? And he doesn't know his name. And then he gets punished for it, and that name is the name of the klipot that they're asking him. And if he would only know it, knowing it means a person recognizes his faults and overcame them in this world. When a person can recognize what are his challenges in this world and overcome them, that's called he's defining the klipot. He's giving them a name, and then he can conquer them. The rasha who never spends his time to define his klipot and never conquers them, so then when he passes away, they ask him, what's your name? He knows the name of his neshama. He knows the name his parents gave him. He doesn't know the name of the klipa because he didn't spend his time in this world to discover what are his challenges, how does he become a better person, how does he overcome it. I'll get to you in a second. Is it critical for now? Not yet. Okay. Serach Bas Asher, she went straight into Gan Eden. What does that mean? That means that she conquered her faults. She was able to master what are my challenges in this world. She was able to define her challenges and master them. Meaning, she was able to get the name of her klipot and conquer them. So then that name falls by the wayside. So then the pasuk is stressing v'shem bat Asher. The complete name of the daughter of Asher was Sarah. She didn't have another name. She had one name because she reached the level where she conquered the other name. That's why she never had to undergo death. She went straight to Gan Eden. You guys with me? Yeah, David, that was for you. That was, okay. I don't know what Cleveland Nog is. Now, yeah, it says that too, yeah. Yep. Now, so I think that we could get out of the depths that we just discussed and think practically. We all have challenges in life, and we have to think what they are, and we have to conquer them. Call them defining klipot if it makes you feel good. Call them naming klipot. But bottom line, at the end of our days, we're going to be asked, hey, did you recognize what your challenges were, and did you overcome them? We're running out of time, and I want to deal with a few other things because we have, that's why I asked a few to show up. A lot of guys are leaving, so I want to have, I don't know if we're going to get a chance to really talk tomorrow in the party, so I want to take a few minutes in the class to talk today. So let's run through a little bit more, and then we'll go back. So the daughters of Tzlafchad, Jeff. The daughters of Tzafchad come forward and they say, our father died in the desert and he wasn't one of the sinners from Korach. Korach happened 39 years ago. They have to mention he wasn't one of the sinners of Korach. They felt he died from his own sins without kids. So here they said two things. One, he wasn't from Korach. They were scared if Moshe will think he's from Korach, then Moshe will have it in for us. He won't give us what we want. And Moshe sensed that they're worried that he's going to be partial here. Because they didn't come to Moshe when Moshe was alone. They came when everyone was around to ensure that they'd have backing. So Moshe says, okay, if they don't trust me, they're coming to me when everyone's around, we'll ask Hashem. And Moshe takes the case to Hashem. And now Rashi brings another pshat that Moshe said, initially, if you guys have it tough, you can ask me, he said to the judges. So God said, even the humblest of person I take to task on something even as slight as that. And God said, I'll show you on a simple case like this where you should know the answer, you won't know the answer. And that's what happened. They came and they asked. And Moshe said, I don't know, I'll ask God. So they merited to have this ruling called after them. Do you want something? Could be. I don't remember such a thing. Could be, though. I don't know. So it says he should have known, and the reason he didn't know was because he had spoken improperly before. When he appointed the judges, he said, what's too difficult for you, so you bring to me. They said our father passed away with his own sin and that's why he didn't have kids. And that maybe is the source for what people say today, Bavonotenu Arabim. Because of our great sin, such and such is happening. So the Rishonim say that they used to speak that way in Tanakh's time too. our father because of his great sins, and it's a way of taking the blame away from God. Meaning when we say something bad happened, it could be indicative of the fact that we have a claim against God. So you'll notice Sfardim say this a lot. Avonoteinu harabim, my business, whatever. Whenever they say something bad happened, they add Avonoteinu harabim, because of our sins. It's a way of sort of saying, I don't have anything against God, God forbid, I know it's my fault. So they also say, what?
Or kapara,
yeah. So they also said, our father died without sin, without sons, with his own sin. So Moshe asks God, and God tells him the laws of inheritance, which God willing you guys will all learn. Who brought death to the world? The woman who's called life. Chava, im kol chai, right? Chava, like chivya, like the snake. Chava brought death to the world. Woman brought death to the world. So who brings the laws of inheritance to the world? Women, the daughters of Tzlachot. Women who love the land of life, Eretz Chaim, the land of Israel. It's not mine. Nothing I'm saying is mine. The Rabbein Bechaye. God tells Moshe, go up to the mountain and you'll see the land. Go up to the mountain and you'll see it. What's you'll see it? God tells him, when you go up to heaven, then you'll see it. Then you'll see the land of Israel. Because we know that there's the land of Israel here and there's Eretz Chaim corresponding up in heaven. So God says, first you'll see it from life down here, and then you'll go up to heaven and you'll see its correspondence up in heaven. Appoint Yoshua, because there might be fights afterwards. We see that the Torah teaches us we have to be realistic. People sometimes say, be favorable. I told you guys a story when I wanted to put in a jelly bean machine. Right? I used to have a jelly bean. It's one of the ways I made money. I used to have jelly bean machines. So I once had a supermarket where I wanted to put it in. So I had a meeting set up with the head of the supermarket. I show up, and the guy's carrying a bunch of crates. So I start helping him. So he says, what do you want? So I said, it's the month of Elul. You don't believe a guy wants to do tshuva? A guy wants to be a good Jew? I want to help you out. So he says, it's the month of Elul, and we have to be realistic. What do you want? So I said, we were supposed to meet now about putting jelly bean machines in your store. So he said, so that's what you want. Okay. So that taught me a lesson for life. We have to be realistic. It's nice to judge people favorably, but we have to be realistic. God tells Moshe this concept. God tells Moshe, do everything that the Jewish people will see that Yeshua is the next leader. People shouldn't have room to claim afterwards, he didn't have the guts to stand up in front of Moshe. Moshe didn't really approve it. God says no. In front of everyone, you put your hands on him. In front of everyone, let him give the speech. In front of everyone, let him be the one who asks the Kohen Gadol. So it's very clear. There's no room for anyone to make any claims. God says, do everything. And then that teaches us an attitude. People sometimes like to assume there will be no fights. You know, when you buy something in the store and they say, don't worry, come back for a year. Have them write it in the contract. That ensures there are no fights. I have an uncle who's a businessman. He taught me, he said, before you pay the money, and everyone's very sweet, that's when you write everything in the contract. Before you pay the money, everyone's willing to promise everything. Well, Chazal said you have to make a contract. It's Allah and Shulchan Aruch. If I give you a loan of $2, the Allah is, we have to make a contract. What's the idea of the contract? The idea is that people have a tendency to forget. People have a tendency to understand things their way. And therefore, we write contracts. Contracts aren't there for thieves. Contracts are there for us. Us who are good intending people, but we all understand things differently. Contract is there so that there's no room for different claims. This is what it says, this is what we agreed on. And the halacha says in Shulchan Aruch that one should not give a loan, even for $2, without a contract, to ensure there won't be claims later on. Yeah, who wants something? Yeah, Yosef.
What's the level between the Jewish family and Mavis? What's the lie?
You can judge him favorably when it doesn't have to do with your money or his money. The halacha says, if you see a tzaddik that sinned at night, you see a tzaddik, and you see him walking into McDonald's and buying a cheeseburger. By the morning, you have to assume he did tshuva. But what happens if you loan them $10, and then you come and you say, pay me up $10. And he says, I don't owe you a penny. You say, what do you mean, I have the contract? He says, I don't owe you a penny, get out of here. So then the halacha says, as big of a tzaddik he is, you don't have to judge him favorably till he pays you back the $10. We say, wait a second, if he owes you the money, he owes you the money. You have to judge favorably when it's external. Yeah, Josh, you want something?
What happens to a shtar after, say, you get paid back?
So you should give the shtar back and tear it up.
Tear it up?
Either that, or if you lost the shtar, which very often happens, so write him a receipt. The Torah describes the korbanos that are brought every day. One in the morning, one in the afternoon. That's called the korban tomid. I made here a short outline. I'll try to remember to photocopy it. Of the korbanos of every day. The Torah describes the sacrifice that's brought every day as lachmi, my bread. And from here we see that the korban is called lechem. And this has halachic relevance to us because the korban is called lechem. And on every korban we put salt. That's why we have salt on the table. And the bread is considered like the korban. And we have to have salt when we eat the bread. That's why some have the custom, even in Tishrei, when we dip our bread in honey, to also have the salt. And then there are Kabbalistic reasons, which we don't have time for today. The Torah says we have to watch over the korban. And to watch over means that we have to have Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim there. And this is the source for the concept of Ma'amados. The Jewish people were divided into 24 watchings. And each one had representation. They'd go up when they're weak. And they'd pray that the korban tamid of each day would be accepted. God would accept it well for the Jewish people. They'd represent us. Meaning, really, every Jew should spend every day praying that the korban should be accepted well. So they say, we can't do that. Everyone's going to stop working every day to pray for that korban. So the rabbis instituted that we have representation. One another, we represent one another. Each one had responsibility certain weeks to go either up to Jerusalem, or if they were too far away, they'd gather in a city center, and that's where they'd all pray for the korban to be accepted. They would also fast on that time. The korban tamid that's brought in the morning and in the afternoon, we, in correspondence to that, we pray the shachris and mincha prayer. Shachris prayer should really be as early as possible, like with Nate. Now, how come is it that the korban tamid was always brought early in the morning? So how do we come to saying that the korban tamid could be brought 4 hours into the day? So the Gemara, the Medrash says that when King Solomon inaugurated the temple, so he was married to the daughter of Paro. And the daughter of Paro went to sleep the first night with her husband, King Solomon, when they had inaugurated the temple. Now the next morning, everyone gets up early in the morning and they want to open the temple and bring the sacrifice early in the morning. Now they don't have the keys. King Solomon has the keys. King Solomon is at home, and his wife wanted le'enot megufosh lo tzadik. She wanted to have him next to her embedded. So what she did was she had her servants build a copper ceiling over them so that when he woke up in the morning, he looks and he sees a dark sky. He thinks it's the middle of the night. So he was in the house, but I guess she figured a way of tricking him. So as wise as he was, he's lying there in bed and he thinks it's the middle of the night. Until finally, it's 4 hours into the day, he rolls out of bed and all the Jewish people are standing there waiting for him. And along comes Yeravim ben Nevat and he's wagging his finger and he's yelling, Kedaber Ephraim Retet. He's chastising Solomon and he's saying, how dare you do this? 4 hours into the day, the first day of the temple, this is how we bring a sacrifice? Yeravim ben Nevat. And he was a big tzaddik initially. That's why he was appointed to be, when King Solomon's kingdom was divided, God appointed him to head the 10 tribes. So he's giving Shlomo Musar Shmuz. Continues the prophet, Nasahu b'Yisrael, when he himself became the leader of the Jewish people, Vayasham babal vayamot, he himself led the Jewish people willfully to serve idols. It's very easy when we're not the one in command to look at someone and wag a finger and say, you didn't wake up on time. No pun intended, Yosef. It's Yoram ben Nevat. It's between me and him. Yoram ben Nevat. No. It's me. We had a chavrusa. I didn't make it on time. Don't get the wrong idea. It's the truth. What can I do? So Yoram ben Nevat was yelling at Shlomo, but when he became king, he led the people willfully to serve idols. Another thing for you, if we bring two sacrifices a day and there are 365 days in the year, how many sacrifices are we bringing in the year? 730. Come on, guys, all the mathematicians, Lars. 365 times 2, no? 730, very good. The korban tamid is described as timimim, shnaim, layom, whole, two a day. Timimim, the first letter is Taf, that's 400. Shnaim, the first letter is Shin, 300, 700. Layom, the first letter is Lamed, that's 30, 730. Excellent, good point. It's true.
Every 19 years, the average is 365 days.
Ah, good answer. Thank you. What are we going to do when you're not here? Okay. Our holidays, Rosh Chodesh, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, they all get 7 kvasim, 7 sheep added to their korbanos. Aside from every Rosh Chodesh, every Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Pesach, Shavuos, Shmini Atzeres, aside from the Os Tamid, you have 7 of those plus some other sacrifices. Shabbos only has 2 sheep. And this refers to the honor of Shabbos. Shabbos is the double. Remember, every day has its pair. Shabbos doesn't have its pair. God says, I am the pair of Shabbos. And Shabbos gets inaugurated with the concept of pairs. Zacho v'shamo, right? It has a double carbon. Mechalelea mot yumat. V'karata la Shabbat oneg l'kdosh Hashem mechubad. Everything is double. Mizmor, shir. The song of Shabbos is a double song. Mizmor and shir. So Shabbos represents the double, the connection of two, the connection of the Jewish people with God, the connection of Shabbos with God, etc. The Torah tells us when we bring the offering of Rosh Chodesh, ordinarily only a carbon olah is called Lashem, a carbon for Hashem, because only the olah sacrifice goes totally for Hashem. We don't have the reference Lashem on any other sacrifice except for the sacrifice of Rosh Chodesh. It's called Usirizim Echad Lechatat Lashem. A chata sacrifice for Hashem. So the simple understanding is, because other nations would also bring sacrifice to celebrate the new moon, and they're serving it to the moon. And God is stressing, you guys aren't serving this to the moon. This is a sacrifice for me. But there's a deeper Kabbalistic concept that the Gemara refers to, that God says, I want you to bring an atonement for me that I made the Levana smaller. And this, we don't have time to go into today. One possible understanding of this is that God says the fact that I made the world, so to speak, an imperfect world, just as I made the Levana smaller, is something that, so to speak, God says, I want kapara for. Another possible understanding is that this shows that God feels bad that God made it possible for us to fall, and God is showing that God cares for the Baalei Tshuva a lot. The Levana represents a strength that's greater than the Chama in certain respects. Ordinarily, we think the sun has a greater light, but in certain respects, the Levana is stronger. The Tzaddikim are comparable to the Levana. Well, quickly, we don't have time. I'd rather do something else now. So we're going to have to pause here. If we have time later, if you guys want to stay, I don't have time after class today. So maybe Friday, if you guys want, we'll expand on this Medrash. This is a very interesting Medrash about the Levana's being smaller. I want to take a few minutes now to discuss, guys are not leaving the Machon, but they are exiting the Machon. There are a few things which I want us, everyone that's here, to think about. The Medrash tells us that when Yosef was standing and Potiphar's wife was enticing him, so according to one understanding, Yosef was all for it. Vayhi ayom. It was the day. Vayavah baita lasot nachto. He came home to do his work. So Chazal say, what work was he coming home to do? So one opinion says he had the same thoughts she had. He was coming home with the same intent she had. No one's around. It's only him. It's only her. And he walks in. And the stage is set for everything to go wrong until he looks out the window. And when he looks at the window, he sees his father. And Chassidus Rebbe's like to say that the vision that he saw of his father was the vision that he had seen of his father when he was leaving his father's home. And one of the things I think that people have to think about when you're here at the Machon as you're about to leave is, what visions are you taking with you? You've learned a lot here, and there's a lot of material, and hopefully every person has grown. But it's not only a question of what we've learned. I merited to see Baruch Hashem a few great rabbis. I merited to see Rav Halberstam Zatzal, Rav Besson Zatzal, Rabbi Feinstein, may live and be well. Quite a few big people. And I have to tell you that I once went for a meeting. I was supposed to meet Rav Bigon, and the secretary told me, just walk in. And he told me, walk in and sit down. When he's ready, he'll talk to you. So I thought, okay, he's probably on the phone, who knows what. So I said, fine, if that's what the secretary says. So I'll listen, what do I know? I walk in and sit down, and I see him chuckling, and I see him benching. And from all the rabbis I've seen, Anytime I sit down to bench, the vision that comes to my mind is Rav Bigun benching. I've never seen anyone bench like he benches. I've never seen any. There's something special. I don't know if you've noticed it. The way he says a bracha. I'm not saying that's what you should take with you. I know that's one thing I take with me. Anytime I sit down to bench, if I'm in a rush, my guilty feelings stem from Rav Bigun. I feel, wait a second, I should be benching like him. It could be things you saw with your friends. It could be things you saw with someone else. It doesn't matter. But one thing I think is you have to think which pictures you're taking with you, because that's a lot of strength. It doesn't say that when Yosef was about to err, he remembered all the learning he got with his father. It doesn't say he remembered the love for his father. It says he saw that picture. Think what pictures you're taking with you. Every day is going to have its tests. And Chazal taught us that when Shlomo HaMelech was, when he was a child, so his father took his arch enemy, Shimi ben Gera, a man who cursed him out, but he was a big sage. And he took him to be Shlomo's Rebbe, and Shlomo learned by him. And then, when David was lying on his deathbed, we're going to learn next week, he told Shlomo, take care of him. We don't want him to suffer in perdition. Make sure he doesn't die a natural death. You know how he cursed me? He has to be put to death. I cannot do it. You take care of him. So Shlomo, 12 years old, takes his Rebbe Shimi ben Gera and tells him, you may not leave the city of Jerusalem. If you, the day you leave Jerusalem, you'll be dead. So long as you stay in Jerusalem, you'll be alive. And you have everything you need in Jerusalem. One day, Shimi ben Gera's servants run away. He runs after them. He breaks Shlomo warned him. Shlomo calls him in, and Shlomo puts him to death. Next chapter, Shlomo marries the daughter of Paro. So our sages teach us that so long as one is living close to his Rebbe, so long as one is connected to his Rebbe, one does not sin. Only after Shimi was dead was Shlomo able to go ahead and marry the daughter of Paro that brought him to greater downfalls. So you ask yourself, wait a second, this is the Rebbe who he was telling him what to do, right? He told him, don't leave the city of Jerusalem. He put him to death ultimately. But he still had respect for him. I don't know who your Rebbe is. I don't know who your Rebbe is. But it's important that a person has a figure in his life, someone who he respects, someone who, before he acts, and when he's going to be, when he's going to have his difficult decisions in life, he'll think, wait a second, what would I do if he's here? And you should know that this has great halachic implications as well. If we have a person that doesn't keep Shabbos, and he doesn't, we don't know, he doesn't keep many mitzvot. But if there's one rabbi, be it the chief rabbi of Israel, who he respects, so then halachically he doesn't make the wine yayin nesech. We could drink it, when he pours a cup of wine, we could drink it. So long as there's one Jew in the world that he respects, that he'll behave in front of that Jew. Every one of us should have at least one Jew in the world who we behave in front of. I don't know who it is for you. You have to decide who it is. But think about it. And I strongly recommend, I can tell you that my being here in Israel is thanks to friends who stayed in touch with me from Israel. When I left Israel, I left, and I was on my way to university, and I was on my way to many things. I wasn't on my way back here so fast. And friends stayed in touch with me and sent me letters, and this is a word to the rest of you that are staying around here. I opened the Google group because I want guys to be able to stay in touch. If you aren't members yet, you guys should be members. I get nothing out of it, but you guys should get out of it. And there should be communication between people. It's very sad that you don't each have one another's emails. You should. Those of you who aren't yet on the Google group, you could email me. A simple email address that I have is machonmeir1@gmail.com. Send me an email. I'll add you to the group. But guys should be able to know where one another is situated. You get off for a Shabbos. Why don't you get together with your friends here? And a few quick words of advice. At life's most difficult junctures, our heart knows what's right. We try not to listen to it. The Gemara says that we cover it with fats. But deep down inside, we always know what's right. God gave us a good neshama and a good conscience. Often when we're in a difficult situation, it pays to share it with someone. And I don't remember which Hasidic Rebbe said this, that a person, when he sees he's going to be put to test, should tell someone else, this is the test I'm in, I have to report back to you what I did. And when we do that, so then we're not alone. That helps us do what's right. That's one of the reasons why men don't like telling their wives what they're doing. Because then when they don't do what's right, there's someone there that knows. But it's a good thing. Our sages taught us it's not enough to make a Rav. And make a Rav, everyone explains, doesn't mean that he's the greatest person. It means it's someone who you've made as your Rav. Could be you're going to be in the army and the rabbi there is not the best rabbi. He's not the biggest Talmid Chacham. Nonetheless, it's important to have a rabbi. Someone who you say, I asked him, this, he told me this is what I do. It's important. You can't take all decisions on yourself. And ideally, you should have someone who you shouldn't second guess. If he says it's mutter, it's mutter. You can't live second guessing. And in the army, you certainly can't live second guessing. It's questions of life and death. It's good that a person chooses a mitzvah, that this is what he's going to be his strong point. Person can say, when I make shahakal, I'm going to have kavana. Doesn't matter what it is. There should be one point that you say, on this, I'm not giving in. This is going to be my strong point. What it is, I don't care. But you have to decide what you connect with. You could say, it's the blessing of Refa'inu in Shmona Esrei. Make it something small. Remember that the small things that we try to achieve, those are the things that last. Don't try to make big storm. Don't try to finish Shas. Don't try to do Daf Yomi. If you do Mishnah Day, you do Halacha Day, I don't care. Slow and steady wins the race. But you should have things. Make yourself goals. Say that on Shabbos, I'll learn one halacha on Hilchos Shabbos. Don't make it 10. One. Make yourself small goals. The mistakes that people make is that they make big goals. Make small goals. And k'nei lecha chaver, acquire a friend. That requires investment. Yeah, you have to acquire a friend. So that means if you have a guy here that you're close with, acquire it. And remember that the surroundings influence us. There's no one can escape that. When you leave the army, take time to land, to reconnect with the Torah. As much as what you're doing is important, at the end of the day, you're not on the level you are today. There's no way a person can go through the army. A person can go up in certain things, but he's also going to go down in certain things. So try to acquire for yourself a period of reconnecting. And after the army, make sure to situate yourself where there are good firm girls. You guys have to get married. Batzlacha. And you should know that if you ever need to call, I hope you know, you could call 24, almost 7. I might not answer Shabbos, but 24 you could call. 7. Yeah. So.